Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A new book by Admiral James Stavridis seeks to understand the value and challenges of the sea. Sea Power, the History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, looks at our relationship to nautical adventure, conflict, and trade. Admiral Stavridis is the first naval officer chosen as Supreme Allied Commander for Global Operations at NATO. He officially took to sea in the summer of 1972 with a sextant, paper charts, and senior officers as his primary guides. If you add up his months on the ocean, he's lived afloat for nearly 11 years. He retired after more than 35 years of active duty in the U.S. Navy. He's written on global security issues for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Atlantic. Admiral, welcome to In the Moment.
It's great to be with you today, and hello to everybody in South Dakota.
Hello from landlocked South Dakota, with a strong history of serving in the Navy, however. Admiral, you start this book with a quote from Shakespeare, and then in the introduction you really talk about that individual sailor's experience on the ocean, and make the argument early on that understanding that experience, as well as the geopolitical impact and strategy of the world's oceans, they need to be understood together. How come? Why is that individual experience so important to the overall picture?
I think in all of our lives, our experiences are additive. And so if you take the life experiences of mariners over the centuries, and the book walks us back through the ancient Greeks and Persians, through the Polynesians in the Pacific, through the rise of British naval mastery, through the rise of the American Navy in the 20th century, all of those mariners' experiences together, both for good and for ill on the oceans, constitute the human experience. And that's what I try to bring it across in the book, because I think the oceans matter so deeply to the fate of geopolitics and the environment on the planet.
And tell us a little bit about, I want to get into the meat of the book, but I'm also fascinated by that early experience where you just sort of fell in love with the sea and realized you were home. Tell us that story.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a Marine Corps family. My dad was a U.S. Marine, and so we weren't oriented toward the ocean particularly. We were kind of a camping family, if you will. And I went off to the Naval Academy, which trains both Marines and Navy officers. And I went to Annapolis thinking I would become a U.S. Marine infantry officer like my dad. One of the things they do at the academy is send you out on a training cruise in the summer. So I went out from San Diego. We got underway late in the day, sailed into the setting sun. I walked up on the bridge, and I was like St. Paul on the road to Damascus. It was just this epiphany of a moment when I realized I wanted to be on the ocean. I wanted to learn to be a mariner, and ultimately I hoped to be a ship captain, which I was. It was one of those striking moments that becomes a hinge in your life.
Right. And those early experiences I mentioned in the introduction, paper charts, really learning how to navigate using the stars. So much has changed, and so much has stayed the same. Let's talk about cyber capabilities, technological advances, and how that's really changed the conversation from a military standpoint, you know, for the U.S. Navy.
Enormous change. And first of all, lifted from the burden of minute-to-minute paper charts and navigation, our ships are much more oriented toward the conduct of combat operations. Secondly, cyber has penetrated every aspect of how we operate our ships at sea today. That's both providing a benefit, but it also provides a vulnerability. So we need to be much more concerned about protecting our ships in a cyber setting than we ever have before. And then thirdly, let's recall that despite all those advances, you still have to be a capable mariner at sea. We've just seen a terrible collision off the coast of Japan, U.S. Navy destroyer, USS Fitzgerald, hit by a Japanese chartered merchant vessel, Crystal, 7 sailors killed. It's dangerous to operate at sea. So I think the point is that in the midst of all the technological advance on the oceans, you have to still be mindful that you have to be a capable, fundamental mariner at sea.
I think I had the same response to many folks when they heard about that tragedy or watched it on the news. Is how in the world could that happen? Yeah. Do you have a sense of how in the world something like that can happen?
I can describe that. And I think if you think of yourself on an 8-lane highway and it's night and it's dark and all you see are lights coming at you and lights going past you, that's what it's like being in that stretch of ocean, except there's one big difference. There's no traffic separation scheme. There's no lanes. There's no median. There's no bumpers on the sides of the road. It's just a big open space. And so you're out there, and all the ships are moving fast, going toward you, coming away from you. It can be very confusing. And when ships are close to each other, those lights at night can be extremely disorienting, and that presents a real challenge. So what I suspect happened is we're going to find there was errors made both on the bridge of the merchant ship and on the Navy ship. But the point is, this is not a pair of ships who are on a big stretch of open, empty ocean. There's hundreds of ships. It's at night. It's a dangerous setting.
I want to talk a little bit about China and territorial ownership of the South China Sea. How do Americans sort of tune into that conversation about what China is doing and think about that in a way that helps us ask the right questions and look to the right solutions?
So when I talk about the oceans, what I try to do is say to Americans, what China is trying to do is essentially take over the South China Sea, and that is the size of the Gulf of Mexico. This would be as though the United States woke up on a Wednesday morning and said, we now own the entire Gulf of Mexico, all the hydrocarbons underneath it, all the islands. We will control all the shipping that moves in and out of it. It's a breathtaking and audacious and completely illegal move under international law. So we ought to worry about that, because if the Chinese claim all that, they will get an endless source of hydrocarbons. There are billions of barrels of oil under the South China Sea, and they will have control of 80% of the shipping that moves through Asia and can choke off our allies, Japan, South Korea, Australia. So we need to push back against this illegal aggrandizement by China, and we're doing so. And that's a good example of why sea power continues to matter if we want to compete geopolitically in the world, which I think we do.
How do the Philippines figure into this, and Subic Bay, and I spent some time stationed there, and just kind of curious about what their role is in that.
Indeed. Well, as you recall from your Navy days, the Subic Bay Naval Station was a vitally important U.S. naval base. We were asked, ultimately, we, the United States, were asked to leave the Philippines as military bases, but we continue to have a very strong alliance with the Philippines. At the moment, the current president, President Duterte, is trying to play a middle game kind of between the United States and China. I think, ultimately, the Filipino people will want that relationship with the United States. Those ties, as you know, are very, very strong. We have many, many wonderful Filipino-Americans in the U.S. Navy as one example of those kind of ties. And over time, the alliance, and we have a defined treaty alliance with the Philippines, I think will cause them to remain oriented in the main sense toward the United States as their security partner of choice. But we need to be careful that they don't drift away.
Let's talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the current administration withdrawing the United States from that. How does that affect this conversation with China and the South China Sea and our allies?
I think the Trump administration has made a geopolitical mistake walking away from that treaty. It was a treaty of 12 nations, which would create an enormous free trade zone, the largest ever in the history of the planet. And it would have bound us firmly with our Pacific partners, allies, and friends. By walking away from it, the United States creates a vacuum. And, you know, not only nature abhors a vacuum, geopolitics abhors a vacuum. And you'll see China move to fill it, and they will find a way to use that kind of economic clout to influence political events to our detriment. So we should have stayed in that treaty. I hope we figure out a way to come back to it before all said and done.
Does North Korea have a strong naval presence?
They have a reasonable naval capability. I would not categorize it as a powerful. Where they are particularly good is in the use of diesel submarines. They might use those to infiltrate special forces into South Korea. They have some capability to fire cruise missiles at offshore ships, but broadly speaking, they are not a naval power, and that is to our advantage. The South Korean Navy is quite capable, aligned with the U.S. Navy. That's a fundamental military advantage we have over Kim Jong-un.
And then Russia and their submarine capability, coming back from a time of some sort of dormancy?
Indeed. If you look at the end of the Cold War, and I don't know when you did your Navy service, but I'm principally a Cold War sailor, we had a very capable foe in the Soviet Navy. At the end of the Cold War, that Navy was broken up, put in mothballs, and by and large stopped competing with the United States. Over the last 7 to 10 years, coincident with the rise of Vladimir Putin, we have seen a resurgent Russian Navy, particularly with an emphasis on two things: powerful submarines and hypersonic cruise missiles that can threaten our aircraft carriers. So Russia is back as a maritime power. That will be part of the challenge in this 21st century for the United States.
How concerned should American citizens be, and how do they translate that concern into action in a reasonable way?
We ought to be concerned about the rise of Russia and the rise of China as maritime powers. We ought to be concerned about the potential for terrorism on the high seas, attacks against cruise liners, for example, attacks on our ports. We ought to thirdly be concerned about the environmental damage to the ocean. All three of those things are clear and present dangers to the United States' role in the world. What we should do about it is work through our elected officials to push for a strong Navy. We have only 275 ships in the Navy today, down from 600 under President Reagan. We need at least 350 in our Navy. And I know it seems a long way from South Dakota. Why do we need a big Navy? The answer is because what protects us and gives us the ability to move trade, 95% of the world's trade moves on those oceans, it's our Navy. So I think that's one thing. And the second thing is press on the environment. We need to reduce pollution. We need to reduce the effects of global warming. All of that over time strategically will impact our ability to make our economy work properly. Those are the two areas I would focus our efforts upon.
Spin that forward a little bit and tell me how global warming changes the conversation at sea.
Mm-hmm. Enormously, because as the polar ice caps melt and sea levels rise, ports are deeply affected. You can't operate effectively in many of the coastal areas of the world. But more importantly, it's the acidification of the oceans as a result of additional fresh water, additional pollution. All of that affects the plankton in the oceans, and here's the real bottom line. 70% of the oxygen we breathe comes from the ocean. The oceans are the lungs of the earth, and if we damage them over time through global warming, pollution, acidification, that over time will be the most dangerous thing that could happen to this planet.
In 35 years of naval service, Admiral, were you able to see that firsthand? Could you pinpoint garbage dumps in the ocean or things like that, or is it mostly an academic experience that you've had?
No. This is real. And in the book Sea Power, I talk about what it's like to sail each of these oceans. And I'll tell you the two places where you really see this. One is in the north, in the high north, in the Arctic, where the ice is melting. And what used to be year-round ice is breaking apart and melting. And the second is in the deep stretches of the Pacific and the Atlantic, we find enormous floating pools of plastics, all of that very deleterious to fish stock and protein. and I would sail through the Pacific through regions where you'd see hundreds of miles of plastics just floating, kind of whirling around in the Pacific Ocean. Over time, that will be very damaging.
And the Arctic, the future of the Arctic, really significant. You point that out in this book as well.
I do. Because of that melting ice, the Arctic will open. There'll be geopolitical competition on the one hand from Russia facing the NATO nations that align the Arctic. It's the United States, Canada, Denmark by virtue of Greenland, Iceland, and Norway. That those partners of ours in NATO will be lined up against Russia. We need to avoid, if I can make a cheap pun, stumbling backward into another Cold War.
If advice for President Trump and his cabinet right now, if you could give them some advice. We already talked a little bit about Trans-Pacific Partnership. What else do they really need to lean into going forward?
I'll give you three things. You mentioned one. It's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The second would be we've got to construct a Navy of at least 350 ships. And number three is we need to work closely with our environmental partners globally. We should be in the Paris Treaty on the environment. If we did those three things, I'd feel a lot more comfortable about the direction that we would be heading in the oceans.
The book is called Sea Power, the History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. Admiral, I want to end with one personal question. I served in the United States Marine Corps at that time in 1988. Women weren't allowed on ships, submarines, anything like that. All that has changed. Can you give me any insight onto the difference that made as you saw that change move forward and we integrated women sailors and Marines into...
I can.
Yeah, please.
I can give a very personal anecdote, which is in 1993, my destroyer, USS Barry, was selected as the first destroyer to have women in the U.S. Navy. And so we took 15% of my crew off, and we brought 15% women onto the ship. So I had a chance to command the ship for a year, all male, and a year and a half with a mixed gender crew. I would unhesitatingly tell you we were a better ship with a mixed gender crew. People were sharper. They were more creative in their thinking. They spent more time working as teammates together. It was in every sense a better ship. And I think that has been echoed by every commander who's made that transition. The other answer to the question, why do we need women on ships, is because we can't man 100% of the fleet with 50% of the U.S. population. We need women. And so there's both a pragmatic and a philosophical performance reason. I think that's a wonderful place to close our conversation.
Yes.
And I'll close it on actually a sad note, which is that the destroyer Fitzgerald lost seven sailors. That was a mixed-gender crew. And I'll tell you, that crew performed magnificently. Men and women together saved that ship from sinking by working together. There's real power in teamwork on ships. Women become an enormous part of that when they join a crew.
Retired Admiral James Stavridis, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.